Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, helping product managers become product masters. Listen and get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad, and this is the place where product managers learn to be product masters. The path to product mastery begins by building your base, moving from being capable to truly comprehending, and knowing what to focus on so you're not overwhelmed. If you've seen my product mastery roadmap, you know I provide the idea framework to help you build your base, doubling your success and your product success. The Idea Framework e-course is open now for new signups. This is the first time I've opened it since February of last year, and the e-course closes again on January 23rd. It covers the entire spectrum of product management: ideation, develop, evolve, and accelerate. That's why it's called the Idea Framework. It includes online lessons and resources, interactive live webinars, and the all-important discussion community for networking and collaborating with other product managers. And the e-course is designed to be self-paced to accommodate any schedule. This is the best way to further develop your skills in product management and innovation. Check out why for yourself before the course closes by going to theeverydayinnovator.com/idea. That's theeverydayinnovator.com/IDEA. Now, for this episode, I have a returning guest, Tony Alwick, who is sharing 6 tools from his new book, Jobs to Be Done, Theory to Practice. Tony is well known for the creation of outcome-driven innovation. And when ODI was published in the Harvard Business Review, they declared it, and I quote, "one of the ideas that will profoundly affect business as we forge ahead in today's complex times." Now, I always enjoy discussing product management and innovation with Tony. He has such deep knowledge and experience, and I expect you'll enjoy the discussion too. He shared an infographic with the descriptions of the 6 tools he talks about in the interview, and you'll find the infographic as well as the summary of our discussion at theeverydayinnovator.com/106. Enjoy the discussion. Tony, welcome back to the Everyday Innovator Podcast.
It's great to be here, Chad. Thank you.
I'm glad you have joined us again to talk about the new book. Now, I need to set the stage a little bit. So I'm holding in my hands the first book of yours I read, which is What Customers Want. And I think this is 2005.
That's right.
And if we had the video up, I could show you all the markups I have throughout the book. Starting with the introduction, it really captured my attention into thinking about innovation in a different way. You know, my original markups, I went back and pulled it out today just to see kind of the notes I had taken in the book as I read. And one of the things you said in the introduction was, customers buy products and services to help them get jobs done. And then a bit later in the same section, in the outcome-driven paradigm, the focus is not on the customer, it is on the job. The job is a unit of analysis. And that is your What Customers Want book. And recently, you have continued this theme with Jobs to Be Done, Theory to Practice, as the new book to talk about. And I have lots of questions to dive into. One completely unrelated, just because I'm curious about things, is that the format of this book just intrigues me, because it feels more like a field guide, right? Something that's easy to throw into a Mac Air bag or something that's small and lightweight. I was just curious about the format before we start talking about the actual content.
Well, yeah, we try something a little bit different because, based on the way people consume materials these days, of course, we have a Kindle version for the book, mm-hmm. but we thought if we're going to print something as well, let's just make it a little more customer friendly, if you will. People trying to get a job done, right?
Right, exactly.
Typically, they want to read a book in a short period of time, maybe on one leg of an airplane flight. So we designed it to be very effective from that standpoint. Mm-hmm. There's very little fluff in there. It's mainly just the key points, and we removed everything else. So hopefully you find that an effective way to consume the book and the material.
I thought it did a good job of cutting through the fluff and diving right into the tools to talk about. this topic of jobs to be done, the jobs to be done framework, you know, this is often attributed to Clayton Christensen, who coincidentally has a wonderful endorsement on the cover of your original book, What Customers Want. But I know there was more surrounding the creation of this jobs to be done framework and the tools with that. Can you share some of that history and what your involvement was?
Oh, sure. Sure. So let me take you back to our beginning. I started my career in innovation back at IBM back in the 1980s. And I worked on a product called the PC Junior that failed and got me very interested in innovation as a process. So in my last 5-6 years or so at IBM, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out a way to innovate that mitigates the risk of failure. Mm-hmm. And in 1990, it occurred to me that what Leavitt was saying, you know, people don't buy quarter-inch drills, they buy quarter-inch holes. That really gives us a different way to think about a market. And the thought was, you know, instead of thinking about how to create a better drill, let's study this underlying process of creating a quarter-inch hole. And my background is as a manufacturing engineer, so I like thinking about things from a process standpoint. Mm-hmm. The thought was if we could think about what the customer was trying to do as a process, then we could apply Six Sigma type thinking to innovation, and we could break down that process into steps and figure out, you know, how people measure success as they go through each step of that job. That was really the basics theory behind outcome-driven innovation. So I left IBM in 1991 and formed Stratagen and began applying the theory in some really good-sized companies. One of the first applications was with Cordis Corporation, who was actually pretty small at the time. They eventually got purchased by J&J. The very first application was very successful. They had released 19 new products in the angioplasty balloon space, all of which became number one or two in the market. Their market share went up from 1% to roughly 20%. Hmm. And it was just a great story. So that really validated the model. And through the 1990s, I worked to work many other companies just to keep refining the model and trying it in different industries and just, you know, trying to make it a bit more robust. And, you know, eventually it became, you know, a pretty robust process. In 1999, after reading The Innovator's Dilemma that Clay Christensen wrote, mm-hmm. I was really intrigued by that book. I thought it was great. And I felt that outcome-driven innovation might be a solution to The Innovator's Dilemma. So I called up Clay and told him that, and he was kind enough to have me come in and sit and chat with him about our approach. And, you know, I met with him for a number of, number of times over the subsequent years, but introduced to him that concept that, you know, people have these underlying processes that they're trying to execute. And if we focus on the process instead of the customer or the product, then we have a much greater chance of being predictable, having predictable success at innovation. So he was pretty intrigued with the idea. You know, we had met a number of times after that. And in around 2002, in one of our conversations, he introduced the idea of the job to me. He says, you know, this concept that people have underlying processes, you know, it's just a hard story to tell, basically. If we say they have jobs they're trying to get done, that flows a lot nicer. And it did, and it does. And he wrote about it in his book, The Innovator's Solution, in 2003, introducing that concept. And over time, the concept became known as jobs to be done theory. And that's how the name stuck. So that's been the progress. And since that time, of course, Stratagen has gone on to refine our approach to outcome-driven innovation, which we'll talk more about today. And the popularity of jobs to be done thinking, I think, has really taken off, especially in the past few years. You mentioned that other books come out recently. So I think that the theory itself is really going mainstream. Makes great sense, simple. It's a great perspective. So with the theory going mainstream, and I think the time is right now for companies to consider it and see how it could work for them to help make their innovation process more predictable.
So it sounds like a good collaboration there with Christensen and his work and your work and coming across the job as kind of the unit to look at for innovation. And this idea, you know, from, you said from Levitt of, you know, we look for not quarter inch drills, but, you know, quarter inch holes that we need done. What I think is important here, you mentioned that this is a, you know, fairly simple sort of theory, you know, jobs to be done theory, that we focus on the problem, the desire that customers have to accomplish. But the theory might, you know, on face value kind of be simple, but without knowing what the specific tools are to apply that theory, we kind of get let down. I think that's a big contribution of your work in the most recent book, is to help us give us that toolkit. Before we dive into tools, I'm curious about one other thing. You shared that kind of your fascination after the IBM PC Junior was investigating innovation approaches that mitigate failures. I share the same interest and passion in the work I do. Why, from all your experience with companies, why do you see companies failing at innovation?
Yeah, that's a great question. And of course, they fail at it for a lot of reasons. But if you were to do the root cause analysis, if you will, and I've thought about this a lot over the years, again, I think we can simplify it pretty dramatically. You know, I think about innovation as the process of coming up with solutions that address unmet customer needs. So that's, you know, at a high level, it's pretty simple what we're trying to accomplish. Now, in order to make that happen, we have to know what a need is. We have to know what the needs are. We have to know which needs are unmet. And we have to be able to discover segments of customers with different unmet needs. And I think companies fail at innovation because they can't address those four key elements. In many companies, there isn't agreement as to what a need even is, or what types of needs exist, or how they should be stated and communicated. And of course, if you can't agree on what a need is, then you can't agree on what the needs are and which are unmet, and if there's segments of customers with different unmet needs. And so I think that's really where it breaks down. So if you're to really analyze the entire process, you know, I think that most companies do very well at developing products, and that's not where they're failing generally, but they're just developing the wrong products. So the input that goes into the process, which is what the product definition should be, I think really is the key variable that needs to be controlled. And if we can come up with solutions that we know in advance will address a large number of customer unmet needs and help customers get the job done better and or more cheaply, then we're making innovation more predictable. So that's really been our focus. I think getting that part of the equation right is the key to success. All the other downstream activities, while they could contribute to failure, I think, you know, pale in comparison to the issue that we're focused on here.
So for the unmet needs, so going back to the root cause analysis of why innovation fails is related to these issues around these unmet needs. Is it fair that I'm thinking about the collection of unmet needs is really related to the job we're trying to get done, right? If I'm trying to dig a hole in the backyard, you know, so maybe some of my needs are to minimize my physical efforts, not get dirt in places I don't want to get dirt, right? And have a nice clean hole dug. And those needs then compile into the job that I want. Is that the right way to think about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. So just to clarify, you know, the job may be to excavate the backyard or just dig a hole. Mm-hmm. And those other statements that you made are outcomes associated with getting that job done. You know, and we'll talk more about that as we go through the process. But that's right. You know, at a high level, you're defining the job you're trying to accomplish. And then you can break down that job into its component parts to figure out how are you going to measure success. And the statements you made are your, you know, top of mind metrics that you're going to use to measure success when getting the job done. So at a high level, that's all we're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. And so now it's time to dive into tools that I'm really anxious to get to the details of implementing jobs to be done theory through these tools. And just reading from the table of contents of your new book, you know, some of the tools that are there, the needs framework, the growth strategy matrix, outcome-based segmentation, you already mentioned the need for segmenting customers, outcome-driven innovation. I would love to summarize, you know, talk through those with you, if you could summarize the purpose of each and, you know, some details about applying that. And you did, right before we started our discussion, you had sent me an infographic which addresses many of these, correct?
That's right.
And so I just want to tell everyday innovators listening, I will make that available too. It will be in the show notes for the episode here, which will be at theeverydayinnovator.com/106. As Tony, as you talk through that, know that listeners have access to finding that graphic too.
Well, what I thought would be helpful is to take these in order, and just try to explain how all the pieces fit together. You mentioned, the matrix, the needs framework, and so on, and outcome-driven innovation. I think of outcome-driven innovation as the broad blanket process. So everything we're going to talk about is part of the outcome-driven innovation process. And the infographic lays out six steps associated with the process, from defining the job to be done to conceptualizing new products. So all these other pieces are steps in the job of innovation, if you will. And I'd like to align them with the thoughts already put out there, which is that to be successful in innovation, we need to define what a need is and what the needs are and which ones are unmet, and if there's segments of customers with different unmet needs. And the first four steps of the process do exactly that. That's the goal, those first four steps. And then once we know what the segments of customers with different unmet needs are, then we're in a position to formulate our market strategy, a value proposition, and create new products and services. So what I like to do is just start at the beginning, mm-hmm. The first step here, just defining what is a need. And to answer that question, that's where we go to jobs theory. And we say that people are buying products to get a job done. And if we think about the job as a process, we can break that down into process steps, and we can figure out how people measure success as they go through each step of the job. And if we had that complete set of metrics that they're using in front of us, we could then start figuring out which of those are underserved, and can we create solutions that will address those underserved metrics to a greater degree. So the way we're going to define a need is a set of metrics that people use to measure success when getting a job done. So that's the first step. So we can agree on what actually is a need. What are we looking for? And in order to do that, we created the job map. That's the key tool there. And we have a article that we published in Harvard Business Review back in 2008 called The Customer-Centered Innovation Map that gives quite a bit of detail on this. But the concept, pretty straightforward. A job map breaks down that underlying process into its process steps, so we can figure out step by step exactly what the customer is trying to get done. So as you're digging that hole in your backyard, for example, mm-hmm. You want to plan first. You'll say, well, how big do I need it to be? Am I trying to bury some utilities? Am I trying to dig a pool? That will define, determine what it is you're trying to accomplish and how big that hole must be. Then you got to go gather all the inputs that you need in order to get the job done. You may have to hire some equipment or just simply get a shovel, depending on what it is you're trying to accomplish. Then you got to prepare all that, get everything in place, put your wheelbarrow where you need it, and begin digging. And as you're digging, you're going to monitor that process to see, are you achieving the goals as you originally defined them? Is the hole wide enough? Is it deep enough? What happens if you run into a rock? How do you remove that? And you'll modify your process as you go through that. And then eventually, you've got the hole in the shape that you want, the depth that you want, and you would conclude. So what we're doing there is we're laying out what it is you're trying to accomplish. Now, a job map's different than a customer journey map or process map in that we're not defining what you're trying, what you're doing from a solution standpoint. We're defining what you're trying to get done. And the way I like thinking about that is, the ultimate job map will work for any situation in which you're trying to get the job done. So whether you're digging that hole in the U.S. or China or Russia or Brazil, and whether you're using a shovel or an excavator, you're still going through the same steps to try to accomplish the same goal. So the job map is created independent of solution, independent of geographical boundaries, of which jobs don't have. And once we have that complete job map in place, we have a really good sense of what the ultimate solution will have to do, which is to get the entire job done on a single platform. So we love creating that job map because it gives you that future vision, if you will, what eventually you're going to try to accomplish, which is to get that entire job done on a single platform.
So the jobs to be done framework is creating the job map that tells, lets us understand from the customer's perspective what the customer is trying to accomplish.
That's correct.
And that's where we start. Okay.
Okay. So now once we know where we're starting, we know what that job is, then the second question is, well, what metrics are people using to measure success and value as they're attempting to get that job done? Now, so we call these statements desired outcome statements, and hence outcome-driven innovation, because the goal here is to, you know, come up with that complete list of metrics that people are using to measure value. And once we know them, we can then evaluate different solutions against them to see, you know, how well they're getting the job done. That's really key to the entire process. What we did in this latest book is we introduced the jobs to be done needs framework. What we've learned over the years is that, you know, being able to classify needs correctly is critically important. And having a categorization method really helps overcome a lot of issues related to, you know, the complexity of this process. So let me explain that just a little bit. We've determined that there's really five different types of customer needs. And, you know, we talked about one of them, which of course is, you know, you focus on that core functional job the customer's trying to get done and understand the metrics they're using to measure success. That's key in order to, you know, get the job done better. So that's why we want to spend time understanding that set of inputs. But there's also related jobs that people have. You know, while you're trying to dig that hole in the backyard, for example, maybe you're trying to stay hydrated because it's a hot day and you're sweating. And so there's going to be some related jobs that are associated with getting that core job done. And if you can provide a solution that gets multiple jobs done instead of just one, then that solution is more valuable to the customer. So we really want to understand what those related jobs are so we have another opportunity to create more value for the customer. The third piece is the emotional jobs. And it's certainly true. You know, customers have emotional jobs are trying to get done while digging that hole. You know, they want to maybe be perceived helpful to their family unit. Maybe they want to be perceived a certain way by their neighbors and so on.
I want to look as the king of my yard digging that hole out there, right? So this is important.
That's right. And so to achieve that, you know, we need to know what that emotional job is. And we want to be able to position our product around that, you know, given that the function that's helping you deliver is going to make you look like the king of the backyard that you're hoping for. So knowing what those are is critical. The next piece are what we call consumption chain jobs. You know, people have to purchase a product. They have to install it, set it up, maintain it, upgrade it. Now, these are all part of the product life cycle, if you will, and they're all really important. And a lot of times when you talk to customers about a better product, this is where they start talking. You know, they're communicating value along some of these dimensions. So this is where a lot of the typical conversation lies when you're talking to customers about needs. Now, understanding what all these needs are is critical, and putting them in the right perspective makes really important sense. And one of the things I want to point out here is there seems to be a lot of confusion about the purchase process. You know, when, of course, people have to buy the product, but when they're buying the product, they're not using the product, right? They're just buying it and they have to go through a process. We've actually studied this as a job, right? Where people, you know, they discover they have a problem or a job they're trying to get done and they're looking for solutions. So they go look in the marketplace to see what the alternatives are. They think through the evaluation criteria to decide which one they want to buy. And then they decide which product they want to buy, then they have to go figure out where they can go get it and, you know, look at alternative places to buy it from and finally make the purchase. So all that's part of the purchase process, but that has nothing to do with the core functional job the customer's trying to get done. And, you know, thinking about these things separately is absolutely, you know, critical to success. So, you know, that's why we like breaking this out into these different categories so you can see where all the pieces fit and where they have to come together to, you know, to paint the full picture. And there's one more piece here too, which is the financial outcomes that the buyer uses to get, you know, their job done, which is to make that purchase decision. And in a lot of the markets we work in, the buyer and the user are two different people. You know, in the medical space, the buyer and most often never even uses the product. But they do have financial metrics that they're using to say, you know, product A is better than product B. And so knowing what all these different variables are is the key to success, because what we're trying to do is to create a product that gets the core job done exceptionally well. We want to know what those related jobs are so we can make our platform more valuable. We want to know what the emotional jobs are so we can position our product around those emotional jobs. We want to make sure the consumption elements are all taken care of so the product is easy to install and set up and use and interface with and so on. And of course, if we can do all those different things, it often helps to get the job done, you know, better and or more cheaply, which relates to the buyer's financial outcomes as well.
Say, taking these five customer needs together also reminds me a little bit of Jeffrey Moore's whole product concept, that we're trying to deliver as much value as we can in a number of areas, like that consumption chain, like in satisfying emotional needs also, like in related jobs a customer might want to get done. So not just focused on that thing that we started with, the most apparent need, but that whole product, all those needs.
Well, that's right. You know, when we think about why innovation fails, it can be explained by this, needs framework. Innovation fails because somebody didn't discover what those unmet needs are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in every case, it's different. You know, in some markets, maybe it's those consumption chain jobs that are underserved. Like in the case of siding on a home, for example, maybe it's the installation job that's really the critical element that's causing, or that could be a competitive advantage for a newcomer into the marketplace. Whereas in a surgical or medical space, you know, getting the core functional job done better certainly outweighs, you know, making the product easier to clean or that kind of thing. So, you know, every market's different. And what we're trying to do here, if you think about it from a causal factor standpoint, you know, it seems like innovation is unpredictable. But if we can understand all the factors that cause variability in causing products to fail, and we could identify every one of them, we can measure and control success of innovation. And this is what we're trying to accomplish. You know, between all the needs in that framework that we just described, there's often, you know, between 100 and 200 different needs, whether they're, you know, related jobs, emotional jobs, consumption chain jobs, or outcomes that make up the needs framework. So it's very complex. It's multi-layered. It's multi-dimensional. And, you know, trying to figure this out without a framework is extraordinarily difficult. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, one of the key things that we bring is, you know, some order to this chaotic process of understanding what the needs are. So that's really the second step of our approach.
Yeah, and I think that framework, that tool is so valuable because it's easy as we're going through a process as product managers to uncover what the customer really needs and what the value points are there, to leave out pieces that a competitor might come along later and say, hey, you know, we could just do this thing that might actually cost us no money in terms of developing the product, but would respond to emotional need the customer has, and all of a sudden makes the product more appealing. And this framework helps us to not miss some of those elements.
That's right. Chad, you know, one interesting thing that we've discovered is that when we fill out this framework, a lot of times companies have insight into all these different needs. You know, they reside in the minds of, you know, all the people in the organization. You know, a lot of our clients have, you know, 20, 30 years experience in these markets. So it's not as if they haven't heard all this before. It's just that they don't have it organized. So, you know, when we ask the question, you know, is there anyone in your company that knows all the customer's needs? The answer is no. But collectively, do you think you know all the customer's needs? And the answer is usually yes. So the goal is to go from nobody knowing all the needs to making sure everybody knows all the needs. And so we'll often spend, you know, a couple of days with a client, and just their team initially without customers, just, you know, extracting what they already know and getting it in this framework. And it's pretty surprising, you know, what you can do in just that short period of time to, you know, take that knowledge and get it into a framework that becomes usable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it helps us organize what we do know.
Right.
Good. Okay. So does that covers the first two. And for people looking at the infographic, we have define the customer's job to be done. And then the second one, uncover the customer's needs. And does this take us to the third element then?
Right. So now we know what a need is and we know what the needs are. The third question is, so which of those needs are unmet? So now, in order to figure that out, we have to define, well, you know, what is an unmet need? An unmet need, the way we define it, is a need that's really important to a customer, but not satisfied given the solutions that exist today. So pretty straightforward. So what we need is some data behind this now to figure out, well, of all these 100 plus needs, which ones are really important and not well satisfied? And, you know, this is where we bring in our quantitative research methods. You know, a lot of companies skip the quantitative phase and they try to, you know, do a lot of customer interviews and use that as a proxy for quantifying, you know, which needs are unmet. But that's really, I think, a sore point in you know, making innovation predictable, because it's really hard to guess or speculate as to which needs are unmet. So we're pretty emphatic here that, you know, data is necessary. So the way we do it is to put surveys out to a statistically valid sample of the population, you know, maybe anywhere from 180 to 3,000 different people. And we ask them to tell us, you know, so when you're going through this step in the job, you know, how important is it to you that you're able to, you know, make sure the hole is being dug to the right depth or whatever the need is. And given that you're using your solution, whether it's that excavating machine or that shovel, mm-hmm. you know, how satisfied are you with your ability to achieve that particular outcome? And so we have customers rate all those different outcomes for importance and satisfaction. And indeed, it takes them, you know, maybe a half hour to do that. So it's a pretty extensive survey, but it's really what's required in order to get the information that you need to determine which of those needs are unmet. So this is really a critical part of the process, because, you know, you're looking at all those variables that exist between your core functional job, related jobs, emotional consumption, and you're trying to handpick which outcomes are underserved. So doing that qualitatively, we think, is one of the key causes of failure in the process, because it makes it extremely difficult to pick out, you know, which needs are unmet.
And it's also not an easy activity. Let me ask you a couple questions about that come to mind. One is, since you're going after a statistically relevant sample, as you said, this can be a fairly good size number of people, right? A few hundred to a few thousand. And it's not necessarily a short survey to complete. I'm curious about the incentives that you have found that work to help, you know, incentivize people to actually take the time to do that. And also, what are you actually, how are you structuring the survey to get this data to make it easy? Like, for example, a sophisticated tool I've used in the past is analytical high-grade process, which allows us to, you know, quantitatively rank or order different factors against some criteria, and also identify how significant each one of those is to someone's assessment of importance. These sort of tools are pretty laborious to work through for someone answering the questions. Tell us more about what you do.
Sure. And the infographic lays it out pretty nicely as well. We've, over the years, come up with the best way, the most effective way to answer the ask the questions to get good discriminated answers and, you know, accurate answers. Mm-hmm. So we we list out each outcome in a job step, and we present, you know, all the outcomes in a job step to the participant, you know, at one time. So there might be seven or eight statements that they'll see at once. And they're laid out just in the order that we show here. You know, how important is it that you're, you know, able to do whatever, and, you know, what's your level of satisfaction given the solution? We put them side by side, so it's actually very quick for them to go through and respond to those questions. And each section, you know, takes maybe a few minutes. And as they get through the entire job, which might be, you know, 12 or 15 steps, you know, that's where we start getting into that, you know, 25, 30 minute time frame. So it's we've proven out this model. We did some work with Microsoft. We did about 45 projects with them back in the early 2000s. And we tested lots of variations of questioning to come up with the most effective manner of doing this. And we've refined it a bit since then as well. But we feel very comfortable that what we're getting here is, you know, very accurate data. We also know that, you know, with these surveys that, you know, some people are going to you know, skip through it. And we've got a lot of great quality checks in place to make sure that, you know, people that are taking a 30-minute survey don't finish it in 10 minutes, and that there is discrimination between the needs and so on. Mm-hmm. So in any given survey, we probably filter out between 5 and 15% of the participants, even if we're paying them to take it. So that's all the fail safes that come into play to make sure that we're getting good, accurate data.
And then in terms of incentives, you mentioned paying people to take it. I don't know if your company Stratagen does this yourself or if you work with market agencies to identify, you know, the right target people to take the survey and then basically hire them to take it, paying them to take it. What do you do for incentives?
Yeah. And so we usually determine who we want to take the survey, mm-hmm. and then we will, put the screening criteria together to make sure we find the right people, and our research firms will find those people. The incentives are vary in our B2C environments. You know, oftentimes these research firms have panels set up and they have a prescribed method for paying them, which makes life a bit easier. Huh. And a lot of B2B environments, that doesn't exist. And maybe half our clients work in that space. So we have to incent them. So we'll often pay them anywhere from $100 to sometimes $250 to take a survey, depending on who they are and what their time might be worth. So it can get expensive, but it's all a fine balance, right? What we're trying to do here is we're trying to mitigate risk and figure out exactly where the unmet needs are. So
exactly. The cost of missing an unmet need can be very expensive.
Yeah, exactly. I think, the return is certainly there.
Okay, good. Thanks for going through that with us.
Sure. And the fourth part of the process is really one of the most critical and one of the more exciting as well. What we've learned over the years is that in any market, people just don't agree on what needs are important and unsatisfied. In other words, markets aren't homogeneous, right? There are different segments of customers that have different unmet needs. And that's marketing 101, right? And it's true. We've got data to prove this, that, in every market that we've studied over the years, there literally are segments of customers that disagree on which needs are important and unsatisfied. So this really is a great opportunity for us because we're trying to discover segments of customers with different unmet needs. And the only way to do that is to segment around unmet needs. Now, normally that's really hard to do because companies don't agree on what a need is or what the needs are or which are unmet. But we've just taken care of all those three problems. Mm-hmm. So now we have inputs that we can use to literally discover segments of customers with different unmet needs. I really think this is the most powerful part of the approach because trying to discover this qualitatively is near impossible. And one of the examples I like using is with something we did with Bosch, helping them enter the circular saw market back in the early 2000s. And the example is great because that market is a commodity type market, right? And if you look at it, and then when we looked at it as a whole, like if you averaged everybody together, there were no unmet needs. And it was only after we segmented around the unmet needs that we discovered a segment of customers that was about 30% of the market that struggled more than others to get the job done. And the reason they struggled more is because they had to make more finish cuts. They would cut molding to fit in corners and things like that. They had to make longer cuts, angled cuts. And because they encountered those additional complexities, they had unmet needs that the rest of the market didn't have. On the other extreme, we discovered a segment of customers that had no unmet needs and discovered that, they're cutting 2x4s. They're roofers, framers. All they do is cut 2x4s. And they're very comfortable, with the way it's working right now because they don't have to make precise cuts. It doesn't matter where they start or end. If it's straight, they don't have to change the height blade or angle. And so they're really not struggling to get the job done. Now, the reason I like bringing this up is that in nearly every market, there are some segments, some groups of people that struggle more than others to get the job done for some reason. And that underserved segment is often willing to pay more to get the job done better as well. So if we can discover what that segment is and why they're underserved, this presents a great opportunity to create a higher end product that can really drive a profit share strategy for the company. Mm-hmm. And we saw Nest do this in thermostats, right? They come out with a thermostat that costs 7 times more than everybody else's. And you have to wonder, how many people are crazy enough to spend 7 times more for a thermostat? Well, the answer is about 10% of the market. But by controlling that 10% market share, they controlled about 35% of the profit share, which really shook up that industry. So discovering what these segments of opportunity are is really a critical element to the market and product strategy. And it really does go back to marketing 101. We've heard this over the years. You know, in every market, there's segments of customers with different unmet needs. It's true. And if we can discover who they are and why they're underserved, then that really gives us a great opportunity to create value for in a unique way. I did want to point out here as well, the output of the segmentation process is a segment and a description of that segment, and a lot of companies view that as like a persona. And you could say that it is. It's a persona or a segment description. But what a lot of companies are trying to do is to start the process by creating a persona. So before they even decide what a need is, they sit around and brainstorm a situation of customers and some demographic variables that are causing them to have some set of unmet needs. So what a lot of companies are trying to do is they're trying to get this job done by going through steps 1 through 4, but they're just skipping all the steps and just trying to jump to the answer using qualitative persona methods. And I find that interesting. I mean, the goal is noble, of course, but it's very hard to come up with a quantitatively valid persona if you skip all those steps.
Yeah, this provides the underlying foundation for knowing if you really have a segment worthwhile to go after or not. Very helpful tool.
Exactly. So let me just finish up the last two steps. In the book, we introduce a new matrix called the Jobs to be Done Growth Strategy Matrix, which I really like. It takes the jobs theory to a little different level. And the basic premise behind it is very simple. Of course, people buy products to get a job done. And winning products will help them get a job done better and or more cheaply. Uh-huh. Well, if that's the case, then we can start looking at these different scenarios where, who would want a product that gets the job done better and more expensively? Well, we find that in a differentiated strategy like the one Nest used, that works pretty well. Or, what if we get the job done worse but cheaper? Well, that's more like a disruptive strategy where, that strategy would work if there is an underserved if there is an overserved segment. And then we have a situation where, maybe you can get the job done better and cheaper. Well, that, of course, is a great strategy, right? Because that wins every segment of the market. Whether you're overserved or underserved or non-consumer, that would be very attractive to you. And what we've done is we've laid out these different scenarios and what might occur. And the segmentation feeds this. What I mean by that is if in the segmentation exercise we discover that there are no overserved segments, then a differentiated strategy is simply off the table, because we could come up with a product that gets the job done worse and cheaper, but nobody would want it because there are no segments of customers that are overserved. By the same token, if the segmentation reveals only segments of customers that are overserved, then a differentiated strategy is not going to work. So if we come up with a better product and try to charge more for it, we're going to fail because there's no market for it. There is no segment that would welcome such a strategy. So laying this out has been really helpful because it helps to point out how to lay out your market portfolio strategy to figure out what segments to position or what products to position at different segments, and align all this correctly. So that tool, it's new in the book. This is the first time we released it, and I think that in and of itself is a really interesting way to think about disruption, differentiated strategies, dominant strategies, and we spent a good couple of years trying to figure this out, get it in a format that's consumable, and we think we've achieved that goal.
It's a great little tool for, first off, there's not a 2x2 matrix that I don't have some affinity for because they just communicate things nice and clearly and simply. But this is a good one to look at that correspondence between cost versus the getting the job done and where you fall in the quadrant and uncovering potential segments also that you are not addressing that you could.
Yeah, exactly. So once we get to this point here, what we've got is our target segments. We know what needs are unmet. We know what strategy to pursue. And so it's time to come up with new product concepts. But the advantage here now is we know exactly which needs and segments we want to go after. So I can go back to that Bosch example. What are the chances that Bosch would have come up with a circular saw that addressed the needs? There were 14 unmet needs in that case. that address those 14 unmet needs of customers in that segment if they didn't know that segment existed and they didn't know those needs existed? And of course, the answer is pretty slim. Mm-hmm. But if they knew exactly what those unmet needs are and why that segment existed, they can come up with a solution pretty quickly to address those needs, which is what they did. In that case, it took them just 3 hours to come up with the idea for the CS20 circular saw. So those steps wrap up the basic approach. But of course, once you have this data, you can use it to create value propositions. Companies use it to evaluate different M&A opportunities, to do competitive analysis, to prioritize initiatives and investments in R&D, to create purpose brands. So it has a lot of far-reaching effects downstream. And it all comes and all stems from being able to answer those four key questions. What is a need? What are the needs? Which are unmet? And are there segments of customers with different unmet needs?
Yeah, going back to how you framed the history of this a little bit, that when we first were talking, that your background is from the engineering manufacturing processes. And this lays out the methodology of processes to get to the point so the engineering design team can actually start, as you said, conceptualize, developing the solutions for what you now, no kidding, know are the unmet needs that customers would value if you could figure out a way to solve them.
That's right. And the goal here is just to mitigate risk of failure, right? Mm-hmm. So if we can identify what all those variables are that could potentially cause failure because we didn't address them, which are the unmet needs, then if they're revealed, then we have a much better chance of succeeding.
Thank you for walking through the six steps there that are in the infographic and obviously in much more detail in the Jobs to be Done 30 to Practice book, which is a great addition and so glad to see that available and that you've put it together for us. And as listeners know, I love innovation quotes and I asked you to bring one to share with us too. What is that and why did you choose it?
Yeah, I like that as well. And it got me thinking, I've been reading so many different books about jobs theory lately and different insights, but I'm going to go back to something that Clay just said in his recent book. He says that the theory of disruptive innovation does not tell you where to look for new opportunities. It doesn't predict or explain how specifically a company should innovate to undermine the established leaders or where to create new markets. It doesn't tell you how to avoid the frustration of hit and miss innovation, leaving your fate to luck. It doesn't tell you how to create products and services that customers will want to buy and predict which new products will succeed, but the theory of jobs be done does. And I found that to be pretty profound. And the reason is, when I approached Clay with outcome-driven innovation back in 1999, my thought was that it really is a good solution for the innovator's dilemma. And, 18 years later, I think that Clay has reached that same conclusion. So I find that extremely exciting.
Collaboration has gone around full wheel, and that is a great quote to illustrate that also. How can listeners find out more, certainly about getting your book and more about the work that you do?
Well, in terms of the book, it's available on Amazon. So it's in Kindle format and in the paperback, which, as you said, is in a format that's easily carried in a satchel or even your pocket for that matter. And there's a lot of new information on our website at stratagen.com with a new jobs to be done page, which takes you through a pretty interesting journey on all the different thoughts that we've had about it over the years with different tools available as well. So I think those would be great starting points.
And what's the URL for that page?
It's stratagen.com/jobs-to-be-done.
Great. And I will make sure, listeners, that you have that information in the show notes, the summary of our discussion and those links. And I was skeptical as you were talking if I could really fit this in my pocket or not. But indeed, it does fit in the back pocket of my jeans. And so it is like a field guide where you can bring it with you, quickly turn to a tool, and start putting that tool to use. Tony, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you going through your new book. More importantly, I appreciate you writing this book for us. It has important tools for innovators to use. And thanks for being with us today.
Chad, my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Everyday Innovators, I so appreciate you listening. Please check out the Idea Framework e-course for yourself and see how it can double your success and your product success without feeling overwhelmed before it closes on January 23rd. Go to theeverydayinnovator.com/idea. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to The Everyday Innovator, which teaches product managers to become product masters. For more resources, please visit our blog at theeverydayinnovator.com.